In 2014, a young Black British journalist named Rini Edo-Lodge wrote a blog post that would change her life, "Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race." She was tired, tired of the glazed eyes, the defensive postures, the accusations of being angry whenever she tried to discuss structural racism. She wanted to step back, to protect her energy. Instead, the post went viral. Ironically, her declaration of silence launched a career of speaking everywhere, festivals, television, schools, about the very topic she'd wanted to escape. The book that followed has sold over 1 million copies worldwide, praised by everyone from Emma Watson to Marlon James, becoming required reading for anyone serious about understanding how racism operates in modern Britain. As the nation grapples with its post-Brexit identity and colonial legacy, this unflinching examination offers both mirror and roadmap for a country still profoundly uncomfortable with difference. Britain's racial history predates post-war immigration by centuries, embedded in the nation's wealth and architecture. Liverpool's Albert Dock, where 1.5 million enslaved Africans passed through, stands as physical evidence. The 1833 Abolition of Slavery Act ended an institution lasting over 270 years, during which 11 million Africans were transported across the Atlantic. When abolition came, the 46,000 British slave owners, not the enslaved, received compensation. This legacy continued through both world wars. Over 1 million Indian soldiers fought for Britain in WY1, promised independence in return. Despite their service, sepoys ranked below the lowest white British soldier and received treatment in segregated hospitals. Around 74,000 died, yet Britain withheld independence. Summer 1919 brought brutal race riots across Britain. In Liverpool, Charles Wootton was chased by a white mob, thrown into King's Dock, and pelted with bricks until he drowned, a public lynching. The government responded with a repatriation drive, sending 600 black people back where they came from. Throughout the 1950s, the government denied Britain's racism problem. Labour MP Archibald Fenner Brockway's race discrimination bill was defeated 9 times. The 1962 Commonwealth Immigrants Act restricted immigration rights, reclassifying Commonwealth citizens as immigrants requiring work permits. When 19-year-old Jamaican Guy Bailey faced discrimination at a 1965 Bristol Omnibus Company interview, the receptionist told the manager, "Your 2 o'clock appointment is here, but he's black." This deliberate test by the West Indian Development Council exposed the company's color bar, launching the Bristol bus boycott that forced the company to end discriminatory hiring. In the 1970s, police wielded sus laws to stop anyone they suspected might commit a crime, disproportionately targeting black people. Summer 1981 saw riots across Britain sparked by police harassment, including the Brixton riot following Operation Swamp's 1,000 stop and searches in 6 days. Lord Scarman's inquiry recommended increasing black representation in police, but controversially concluded institutional racism wasn't the problem. In 1983, Labour's black sections emerged, leading to Britain's first black MPs in 1987, Diane Abbott, Paul Boteng, and Bernie Grant. Structural racism operates covertly through documented patterns. Applicants with African or Asian-sounding names receive far fewer interview callbacks than those with white-sounding names. Young black men face disproportionate unemployment. 45% of black 16 to 24-year-olds were jobless in 2012 versus 27% in 2002. Despite lower usage rates, black people are twice as likely to face drug possession charges, 5 times more likely to experience harsh police responses, and appear on Britain's national DNA database at 3 times the rate of white men. Many dismiss efforts to address systemic disadvantages as special treatment rather than equality of opportunity. The merit argument ignores how whiteness itself confers advantage. The homogeneous presence of middle-aged white men in leadership contradicts meritocracy claims. Colorblindness offers simplistic analysis that ignores power dynamics and silences people of color. While white children learn not to see race, children of color learn they must work twice as hard, revealing that acknowledging race is essential to dismantling unjust systems. White privilege manifests as an absence, the absence of negative consequences from racism. It's not having your race viewed as a problem, not receiving suspicious looks in spaces where you belong, not carrying generations of marginalization. This doesn't mean white people haven't struggled, but that their race positively impacts their life trajectory in ways they rarely notice. Racism differs from prejudice through the equation prejudice plus power. While people of color can be prejudiced, they lack the institutional power to enact systemic racism. White privilege operates as a suffocating blanket, forcing people of color to bite their tongues for fear of losing jobs, homes, or relationships. It owns the industries that employ you, making honest conversations about race professionally risky. You learn to carefully choose your battles, lest you be dismissed as an angry Black woman obsessed with race. When MP Diane Abbott tweeted during the Stephen Lawrence trial that white people love playing divide and rule, the media immediately shifted focus to her supposed reverse racism, demonstrating exactly how white privilege silences discussions of structural inequality. Far-right groups have co-opted anti-colonial language, claiming indigenous white British people face siege from immigration. Former BNP leader Nick Griffin compared white Britons to Maori and Native Americans, declaring, "We are the Aboriginals here." This false equivalence portrays accommodation of difference as erasure, despite white people remaining the overwhelming majority. The 2015 Rhodes Must Fall movement at Oxford exemplifies this dynamic. Students campaigning to remove Cecil Rhodes' statue, a colonial businessman who displaced Africans and laid apartheid's foundations, were accused of restricting free speech. This dishonest framing reveals how freedom of speech becomes a weapon protecting white people from criticism. This resistance demonstrates how racism impedes empathy. Non-white people have identified with white main characters since film began, while white audiences struggle relating to Black protagonists. White people are so accustomed to seeing themselves reflected everywhere that they only notice representation when it's taken away. The paradox is clear. If racism doesn't exist as claimed, why fear becoming a minority? When a 17-year-old white girl asked when racism will reach an end point, the answer was stark. There is no end in sight. You can't skip to resolution without difficult conversations first. Real anti-racist work requires concrete actions, providing financial support to established groups, actively intervening when racism occurs, and advocating in all white spaces where marginalized voices are absent. The Grenfell Tower tragedy, which killed 71 marginalized residents, became a powerful symbol of how race and class intersect to devalue lives, their safety concerns ignored, their humanity sacrificed for cost-cutting. The book's publication coincided with far-right politics rising across Europe, Brexit, and Trump's election, an atmosphere where British citizens of color were told to go home. Racism is structural, seeping into housing policies, healthcare access, and educational opportunities. Dismantling it requires fundamental changes in workplaces, social circles, and institutions. Challenge hiring practices, question school curricula, examine banking policies perpetuating racial inequalities. This isn't about white guilt, which is paralyzing and self-serving. It's about anger channeled into systemic change. As Terry Pratchett wrote, "There's no justice, just us. Change depends on collective action and individual responsibility through sustained, uncomfortable work that redistributes power and creates genuine equity."